Lars asked the entire assembled group, "Have any of you heard of Simo Heihe?" They gave him blank looks. Lane continued, "He was a sniper from Finland in the Second World War. He was the world's most successful sniper. I read that he had more than 500 confirmed kills. My dad said that Simo Heihe was quoted as saying, 'When you are shooting at wild game, never shoot from 200 meters when you can shoot from 20 meters. But when you are in combat, never shoot from 100 meters when you can shoot from 300 meters. You'll live longer.'" Bradfordsville, Kentucky, February, the second year. Each day that the Seed Lady's store was open, Tyree stood guard in the back room with the shotgun leaning against the wall. He spent most of his days there, absorbed in reading by lantern light. The partition between the two rooms was just a single thickness of horizontal 1x8 tongue-and-groove knotty pine boards, supported by 24 studs. The many small knot holes in the pine boards provided ample opportunity for Tyree to peer through the wall. Under Grandmère Amélie's instruction, Tyree gently tapped out three large knots at shoulder level to give him the chance to shoot through the wall if need be. Each of these knots was replaced loosely and labeled with a piece of phosphorescent tape. These knot plugs could be easily popped out from behind the wall with just a forward thrust of the shotgun's muzzle. Whenever Tyree heard the bell at the store's front door ring, he would spy through a knothole to observe the newcoming customer. By prearranged signal, if his mother rested her hands on the counter, that indicated all was well and he could go back to his studies. But if she stood with arms akimbo or folded across her chest, then that meant that Tyree was to be vigilant and keep the shotgun in hand. And if Tyree ever heard his mother shout, "My husband is watching over me," then that was the cue for Tyree to rack a shell into the chamber of the Remington. The first year that they were open for business, he had to do that only twice. Both times, that distinctive sound cleared everyone out of the store very rapidly. 4 months after they opened the store, Sheila bartered for 2 pieces of 3/8-inch thick plate steel. They both measured 28 inches wide by 4 feet tall. To create some armored protection for Tyree, these 2 plates were stacked together and positioned below one of the pop-out knot holes. The heavy plates were held in place with 2 lengths of perforated plumber's steel strapping tape nailed to the studs. Most of Sheila Randall's business was in bartering items of like value or for pre-1965 silver coins. She eagerly sought heirloom seeds for all vegetables. But when she traded her precious, commercially packaged seeds for saved seed from family gardens, she did so at a 1-to-5 ratio, explaining, "I know my seeds are all fresh, and they are guaranteed to sprout, but I can't say that about yours, so my trading ratio is firm and non-negotiable." She later resold the homegrown seeds at a substantial discount compared to what she charged for her commercially packed heirloom seeds. A large whiteboard on the wall behind the south display cases listed current wants, specials, and freebies. A corkboard was put up next to the whiteboard for customers to post their for sale and wanted items on 3x5-inch cards. It took hundreds of trades, but Sheila gradually built up a substantial inventory. Some overstock went in the back room. Eventually, a larger sign on a slab board above the front overhang dwarfed her original window signs. It read, "Bradfordsville General Store, S. Randall, Proprietor." As her inventory grew, Sheila started trading for items of greater value. One of her first major purchases was a .41 Colt Army double-action revolver. It was an ancient gun, with hardly any bluing left on it, and one of its grips was badly chipped at the bottom. but at least it was mechanically sound. It came with a holster and just 34 rounds of ammunition. The merchandise that she traded for it was worth the equivalent of 3 months' wages for most folks. Sheila had been warned that the revolver was chambered in an obsolete caliber, but it was the only handgun that she could afford. She carried the revolver on her hip every day and oiled it frequently. The first year that she owned the gun, she fired just 12 cartridges practicing shooting it. By necessity, most of her practice with the gun was dry practice with the unloaded revolver in the upstairs apartment. She practiced drawing and dry firing the gun 3 nights a week. It was not until their second year in Bradfordsville that her frequent inquiries paid off, and she successfully bartered for 2 full boxes of 41 long Colt ammunition. Those cost her $5.50 in silver coin each. South of Farmington, New Mexico, April, the second year. 2 nights after the water cistern had been pierced by a bullet, the bandits tried to pack up their vehicles. Then the nappy men started shooting. Lars coordinated their fire by GMRS radio. He had positioned himself with the team that had the best vantage point to observe the main road to the grain elevator. The first night, they dropped 4 of the bandits. The next morning, they shot out most of the tires on the bandits' vehicles. In all, it took 2 days, but it was like shooting fish in a barrel. The final score was Nappy 9, Bandits 0. Lars was paid for his services in the form of a credit voucher for 500 pounds of oats. Other than the grain elevator episode, for many months Lars and Lisbeth led a quiet, mundane life. With the help of Kaylee and the Phelps boys, they raised chickens and took up large-scale gardening, with mixed results. Some crops did well, while others failed completely. They were able to trade their excess produce, eggs, and pullets to fill in some of the shortfalls. Still, what they got from the poultry pen and the garden was not enough to feed the 6 of them. Thanks to the silver coins that Lars had inherited from his father, they ate fairly well. It was that silver that made up for the garden's shortcomings. Prescott, Arizona, February, the second year. Life in the 4 families compound continued in a fairly uniform routine. There were a couple of burglaries at some of the outlying houses in the neighborhood, but otherwise things were quiet. They could occasionally hear gunfire in downtown Prescott. This was later explained as having come from small roving gangs who crossed the line when they attempted armed robbery. Later, they heard that the problem was disagreements on what to do with the cars, trucks, and guns that had belonged to the deceased robbers. Their corpses ended up in the Potter's Field at Citizens Cemetery on East Sheldon Street, interspersed with the numbered graves of indigents and criminals dating back to the 1890s. Chapter 29 La Casa de la Mañana Grande. Belize was founded by British pirates. Legend relates that the city was built in a swamp on a foundation of gin pots and mahogany chips. If this is so, it would have been better if the city's fathers had thrown in a few more pots and chips, for Belize is only a few inches above sea level. Time Magazine, September 21st, 1931. The GPS receiver showed the Douro Brabis was 40 miles east of the Belize Keys chain just before sunset on March 26th. 4 months after first setting sail, they were anxious to come ashore. The depth finder showed they were in 300 feet of water, but fearing that they would approach reefs and shallows, Karsten dropped all the canvas and set both sea anchors in order to wait overnight. He had nautical charts for Belize, but they were several years old. Knowing that profiles of sandbars could change in just 1 year, Sims decided to proceed with great caution. He said wisely, I wouldn't want to make it this far, only to end up aground on some sandbar. They spent the evening excitedly listening to Wamalali Radio, an AM station in Punta Gorda. The city was most often mentioned by its nickname, PG. There were also a number of FM stations broadcasting, but they were mostly playing music. Proceeding cautiously, Sims piloted his boat through the Keys late the next afternoon. Not knowing what sort of passport controls might have been enacted under the current state of emergency, they thought it best to wait at anchor on the far side of Lark Key until after dark. They could see lights dotted up and down the coastline. Then, as the next high tide approached, they motored quietly to the nearby point, past the Creole fishing towns of Placentia on the point and Big Creek opposite on the mainland side. As they entered the 12-mile-long Placentia Lagoon, Sims was pleased to note that the local electricity was still on. "A good sign, that," he told Angie. The skipper ran the diesel engine at low revolutions for a quiet 3 knots as they progressed up the lagoon. Karsten kept Angie constantly watching the depth finder. They passed by an odd mix of well-lit luxury homes, mostly at Sane Bite, and completely dark, tin-roofed Creole and Garifuna shanties. They set anchor again just before dawn at the north end of the lagoon, near the village of Blair Athol. This end of the lagoon was very quiet. Just 2 other yachts were anchored nearby, with their sails covered and bright blue canvases snugged down over their stern piloting areas. From their stern markings, they could see that one was from Dunedin, Florida, and the other from Freeport, Texas. They soon learned that both of these yachts were under the protection of a paid watchman from Blair Athol. The black man, armed with a single-barrel shotgun, motored up in an ancient skiff with a round-topped outboard engine that looked like something from the 1950s. It used a hand-wound spin starting rope rather than a recoil starter. The man's shotgun had a well-worn stock and had all of its metal parts covered with thick white grease that looked almost like wax. Andy surmised that it was for protection from salt water. The watchy man, who spoke in a curious Belizean sing-song voice, told them that the recently arrived owners of the boats had moved into houses nearby, one on South Stan Creek and one in the village of Georgetown. Neither of the owners, he said, had any plans to sail back to the United States. He also had been told to relay that neither boat was available for sale or rent. Sims continued talking with the man, making barter arrangements to refill his yacht's freshwater tanks, which were nearly depleted. Meanwhile, Andy went below and started gathering his gear. He explained to Angie, "I want to beat feet before anyone comes here with plans to do a customs inspection." Angie answered, "I think that's wise, Andy. Of course, we won't mention that you arrived with us. It's best that you slip into the country the soft way." After clearing her throat, she added, "Anders, I'll certainly miss the peace of mind that we've had with you on board. I think that buying a gun will be one of Karsten's first priorities here." Inflating the dinghy took less than 15 minutes, and in the dead calm water of the lagoon, loading Andy's gear was easy. The most time-consuming part was first mounting the dinghy's engine and getting the fuel primed properly to feed the engine. As they packed the dinghy, Andy made his goodbyes. Yvonne and Yvette were crying. Andy shook hands or hugged everyone but Simone, who just gave Andy a small wave from the doorway to the salon. Prescott, Arizona, March, the second year. Life at the Four Families compound in Prescott continued in a routine to the point of monotony. Without electricity, just hand-washing the laundry was a huge chore, and there was plenty of other hard work, mainly involving gardening and firewood. Their evenings were short and fairly quiet. Tuesday and Thursday nights were old radio show nights at Dr. K's house. Dr. Karvalich had more than 1,000 old radio shows on a set of 26 CD-ROMs in MP3 format. He had bought the collection through eBay several years before the crunch for less than $30. These were played on his laptop. The most popular shows were comedies like Fibber McGee and Molly, and old science fiction and drama shows like Dimension X and Suspense. Saturday nights were movie nights, with movies on DVDs played on Alex's 17-inch screen MacBook laptop. Blair Athol, Belize, April the second year. Motoring over to the quay took only a few minutes. The village of Blair Athol looked small. There was one fancy estate development to the south at Bellamaya, and a collection of modest tin-roofed houses to the north in the town of Blair Athol itself. In between was a sign that said, Blair Holiday Cottages. Since that sounded vaguely English, Karsten steered toward it. They pulled up to the dock and were greeted by a rotund, aging English expat named Peter Ivans. 10 minutes of quizzing Ivans made it clear that customs officials rarely checked this end of the lagoon, that the only reported troubles in Belize were near the Guatemalan border, and that he would be willing to store Lane's baggage for a nominal fee. After depositing Andy's panniers and duffels on the dock, Sims shook Andy's hand firmly and said,
Well, safe home, Anders? The Lord be with you, Skipper.
He spent the next half hour talking with Peter Ivans, getting up to speed about the situation in Belize and Guatemala. He concluded that Belize was fairly stable, but that Guatemala was in a state of crisis. Several key government officials in Guatemala, Ivans said, had fled the country. Rumor had it for Honduras, and had hence left a power vacuum. Criminal gangs and communist rebels had commenced wholesale violence. Thousands of Guatemalan refugees and bandits were crossing into Belize, Mexico, and Honduras. Andy summarized his situation for Ivans. He mentioned that he had seen the bright lights of Placentia and said that he had made entry into the country, so the man assumed that Lane had cleared customs. Andy asked if there were any ships likely bound for the Gulf Coast of the U.S.
Not a chance, the man said bluntly.
From all reports, Belize is strictly a to-destination, since everything in all directions is substantially more risky. You're sitting in the safe haven. You should think about staying here until things sort themselves out. Then Lane asked about buses heading to the Yucatan. Those, he was told, had all been suspended because of the Honduran and Guatemalan refugee situation.
Is there somewhere I could rent a car? Andy asked.
The man chuckled in reply and said, My boy, getting a hired car was difficult in most parts of Belize even before this crisis. Even if you got to Orange Walk or Belize City, I have terrible doubts that you'd even be able to hire a moped, much less a car. The news on the radio is that they've been having problems with midnight flits. Same with boat rentals. People are petrified of renting out boats or anything on wheels because, sure enough, they'll end up in Mexico or Honduras, never to be seen again. Cars and lorries are getting stolen left and right these days, so you can't blame the firms for refusing to hire them out.
Could I hire you to drive me up to the Mexican border?
Sorry. No. Fuel is nigh on irreplaceable at present. I can't spare any. I've drained all the petrol from my utility and hidden the cans back in the jungle. If they steal my vehicle, they won't get more than a quarter of a mile down the road. Lane pondered that for a moment and then asked,
Do you know anyone who might have a bicycle or a horse that's for sale?
No, but you might go and make inquiries with some of the landholders at Stan Creek. They've lots of horses there.
Okay.
Lane gestured to his baggage and said, Give me a few minutes to organize this gear. Ivans nodded and sauntered off to his office. Andy sat near the end of the dock and sorted his baggage. The dock sat below a set of stairs from the walkway and office above, so he felt safely out of sight. He decided to travel light, He pulled out a 1 ounce American Eagle gold coin and most of his remaining silver coins. He left the rest of his gold hidden in the stove. He briefly debated taking the SIG pistol, but decided that on this trip the risks would outweigh the rewards. He tucked the SIG and all of its accessories in the bottom of the duffel bag with the stove. Then he restuffed the bag full and padlocked it shut. The key went on the chain around his neck that held his dog tags and his P-38 can opener. It took 2 trips to lug the rest of his baggage up the stairs and into the office. The luggage room was just an 8-foot by 6-foot closet with deep, widely spaced shelves. But Lane was happy to see that it was equipped with a solid core door and a deadbolt lock. In his rucksack, he packed 2 cans of stew, a can of corned beef, a bag of raisins, a change of socks, his foul-weather jacket, a water bottle, and a small squeeze bottle of insect repellent. Later, sitting at his kitchen table, Peter Ivan showed Andy a well-worn map of the district and pointed out the road route to Stan Creek. Andy copied his route onto a strip map on a clean sheet of typing paper. On the same page, he jotted down the names of several ranchers whom Ivans had mentioned. It took Andy a while to get his land legs back. When he first arrived on the dock, he had felt normal, but after he began the walk toward South Stan Creek, his legs felt rubbery beneath him, and he had the false sensation of the land rocking. There was no traffic on the Riversdale Road. Andy concluded that Ivans was right about the locals hoarding their fuel. As he walked, he passed by several citrus and cacao plantations and 1 banana plantation. The bird calls were unfamiliar, and the humid air had an odd smell that Andy could not place. The day was warming up rapidly, and Lane felt sweat gathering on his forehead and beneath his backpack. He started moving into more hilly terrain. Suddenly, a group of 5 young men, 4 armed with machetes and 1 with a rusty FAL rifle, emerged from the dense jungle on his left. All of the men had shaved heads, and 3 of them had bizarre facial tattoos. The leader, holding the rifle at waist level, shouted, "Alto!" Andy made a split-second decision. He ran. Knowing that he'd probably be shot in the back if he ran down the open road, he instead headed for the wall of jungle that began just a few yards to his right and plunged in. He raced through the jungle as quickly as he could. He expected to hear gunshots, but there were none. He could hear the men pursuing him, crashing through the brush of the jungle understory. They stayed just 10 to 15 yards behind him, never gaining or losing much ground. The underbrush was clumpy. He hardly noticed the thorns and branches that slashed his arms and cheeks as he ran. Lane knew that if he tripped and fell, the bandits would be on top of him in just moments. His path started out level at first, but after 300 yards, the terrain began to drop off, descending toward a creek. Andy started picking up speed. He heard a shouted curse as one of his pursuers fell, but the others pressed on, losing only just a bit of ground. Andy found it hard to believe that they would follow him so far. He hoped to get ahead of them and hide in thick undergrowth. He could dimly make out some rocks along the creek just 60 yards below. Still running headlong, the ground dropped off unexpectedly, and Andy took a leap. He fell 15 feet, landing unevenly on 1 foot. He heard a loud snap and felt a sharp pain. He fell into a heap. Lane tried to get up to run again, but the pain in his right leg was incredible. It was a bad break low in his femur. The pain was agonizing. He gasped for breath and looked up to see himself surrounded. He exclaimed between his gulping breaths, "Hoover Dam!" His pursuers, also out of breath, were speaking rapidly in heavily accented Spanish. He didn't catch much of the bandits' conversation. He did hear Empaten twice and Poor Guatemala once, so he assumed that they were Guatemalan bandits. He looked up to see the buttstock of the battered FAL rifle just 2 feet away from his face. "Chavo, was carved in the side of the rifle's blue-painted stock, and farther up the stock were carved the letters FSLN. In an oddly detached way, Andy wondered about the history of the rifle. Perhaps it came from the Nicaraguan Sandinistas 3 decades earlier. It seemed surreal, looking at the stock of the rifle with the rusty top cover, and then at the tattooed faces of the bandits. They quickly stripped him of his wallet, pocket knife, wristwatch, belt, and rucksack. One of them started to take off Andy's boots, but his screams of agony stopped the man. The Guatemalans started to argue among themselves. Lane was petrified when he heard one of them use the word Matale, which he knew meant kill him. The leader of the group, who wore jeans and a white tank top, ended the argument by grunting, Santo Dios, vamonos. He jabbed his forefinger toward Lane's face and ordered his silence with a stern, Cállate, before turning to follow the others. The 5 men quietly disappeared into the jungle, walking back up the hill toward the road. Andy thought through his situation. He had no water, food, or shelter. His only tool was a tiny folding can opener. Getting back toward the road, he realized, was his only chance to get help. He also realized that he had to wait at least a half hour to give the bandidos the opportunity to get away. If he called for help any sooner, they might come back and silence him permanently. After a couple of minutes, he caught his breath and became more conscious of his broken leg. He had never felt pain so intense in his life. Sweat poured off his forehead and dripped off the end of his nose as he did his best to straighten the leg out.
Bastards, Andy muttered to himself.
Then looking skyward, he said,
Give me the will to forgive them, Lord.
He waited for what he estimated was 30 minutes, praying aloud. His throat felt dry. Lane started to crawl up the hill, pushing himself with his one good leg. There wasn't much blood from around the protruding compound fracture. Each time that he dragged his right leg forward, the pain made him scream. The screaming set off a nearby troop of black howler monkeys. There seemed to be about 8 monkeys in the troop. One of the monkeys, a large male, came to investigate. Peering down from a tree limb 20 feet above him, the monkey let out a grunt. Then it scampered off. Lane shouted,
Yeah! Some help you are, pal!
Chapter 30 The Samaritan's Purse. One of the common failings among honorable people is a failure to appreciate how thoroughly dishonorable some other people can be, and how dangerous it is to trust them. Thomas Sowell. It took 4 agonizing hours for Lane to crawl up the hill. His elbows and forearms were soon raw. Once he got near level ground, he realized that he still had several hundred yards to go. He doubted that his voice would carry through the dense jungle, so he didn't bother to shout for help. He remembered that he had been traveling due east when he was ambushed, and since he had headed south from the road, he needed to go back north to get back to it. The sun was heading toward the horizon. Andy found a loose branch and laid it down as a pointer to indicate where he estimated that the sun would set. Now on level ground, he tried to stand again, but the pain was too much. He passed out. Lane awoke sometime during the night to find mosquitoes had been feasting on him. The pain in his leg had subsided slightly to an intense throbbing. The buzzing of insects and the many strange noises of the jungle assaulted his ears. Gradually, he fell asleep. He awoke to full daylight. His broken leg had started to swell. He spotted his sunset pointer stick and compared that to the current position of the sun, which filtered through the double canopy of the jungle. He adjusted his direction of travel accordingly and pressed on, crawling. After an hour, Lane could hear a truck pass by on the road. He shouted for help, but realized that he was probably still too far away to be heard. but at least the sound of the truck confirmed that he was heading in the right direction. He picked out a distinctive-looking tree with a splayed top that was along his desired path and began crawling toward it. He had worked out the most comfortable crawling motion so that he screamed in pain only occasionally. As the day wore on, the sky clouded up, and Anders was treated to an afternoon thunderstorm. The rain fell heavily for a few minutes. He reached up and dribbled water from the wet leaves into his mouth. He did this over and over throughout the rain shower until he estimated that he had drunk a liter. He thanked God and pressed on with his crawl over ground that was now muddy. Late in the afternoon, he finally reached the road. He was sweaty and filthy. His upper leg had swollen to 10 inches in diameter. He propped himself up with his back against a stump just 10 feet from the road. He prayed that someone would pass by. Just before sunset, a good Samaritan did. Andy regained consciousness only briefly, as a doctor was setting his broken bone. But then he was unconscious for another 3 days. He awoke in a bed in Dangriga Hospital, bathed in sweat. An IV bag was hanging over his head. The swelling of his leg had decreased noticeably, and it hurt only when he moved. After a few minutes, a nurse came in. She was middle-aged and matronly.
"Ah, the sleeper awakens," she said pleasantly. "What day is it?" "It's Friday. You have been out for 3 days."
Andy asked weakly,
"Could I have some water, please?"
Two police officers from the Dangriga formation arrived that afternoon. Lane described the ambush, robbery, and his crawl back to the road. He thought that it was best if he didn't mention his baggage at the cottages. The elder policeman described Belize as overrun with Guatemalan refugees and robber gangs, as well as some illegal border crossings from Mexico. The words, "I'm an American, and they took my passport," were enough to assuage the police. They said that they'd have someone from the American consulate contact him. They didn't seem too concerned with getting detailed descriptions of the bandits. That afternoon, a young Belizean doctor gave Lane a morphine injection. He returned 15 minutes later and set the broken bone. This was an odd experience for Andy. Because of the pain medication, he could observe the procedure with an almost detached clinical attitude. His main concern was that the bones were set correctly. Later, an older doctor with a Spanish surname, but who spoke excellent British-accented English, examined Lane. He declared,
"Now that the swelling is down, we'll need to double-check the position of the bone with an X-ray and then place a cast on your leg. We'll then follow up with another X-ray just to make sure we didn't misalign the bones whilst casting."
Andy slept very peacefully that night. As he was eating his breakfast, a hospital administrator came to visit. Andy mistakenly thought that he was a doctor at first, but then realized that he was the hospital accountant.
"There is one convalescent hospital nearby, but they're having trouble staying in operation with the recent currency fluctuations. I'll see what can be done," the administrator told them.
The next day, he returned to Andy's room and announced,
"Your medical bill is being settled by the U.S. State Department under a reciprocal agreement. One of our vocational nurses just retired a few months ago. She and her husband have agreed to take you as a boarder. If you can either find a way to pay for that yourself or make some sort of additional payment arrangement through the American consulate."
Andy improved rapidly and was released from the hospital after 5 days. He was taken by ambulance to the home of Darcy Mora, a retired vocational nurse. Darcy's husband, Gabriel, was a semi-retired logger and commercial hunter who had also worked as a hunting guide. Their flat-roofed, cinder-block house was just outside Sarawiwa, 6 miles west of Dangriga. There, Andy occupied the second bedroom of the house. This bedroom had until recently been used by the Mora's daughter, who had just married and moved to Nimlipuni, a town in the southern end of Belize. Darcy was in her mid-50s and overweight. Gabe was in his early 60s and was lean and leathery, with a balding head. His skin was dark, but not just from his outdoor vocation. He had some Garifunan ancestry. Mamoras were pleasant hosts. Darcy was a great cook, and Gabe constantly cracked jokes and puns. Andy missed his next Tuesday night ham radio contact night with Lars and Kaylee, but he had the strength for the next one. On that Tuesday afternoon, Gabe Mora helped Andy set up the radio. Following Andy's directions, Gabe strung the antenna up to a tree outside the bedroom window. A cold water pipe provided a good ground. The propagation was good, so Lars and Kaylee had no difficulty hearing Andy's Morse tones. Lars, with a much more powerful transmitter, came in, "Lima Charlie," loud and clear. As Andy tapped out his messages, Gabe sat on the bedside chair, wiping the sweat from his balding head with a handkerchief and sipping lime water. He was amazed that such a small radio could be used for two-way communication over such a long distance. Andy was reassured to hear that Kaylee was safe and well, but he felt distressed, realizing that his broken leg would delay him by several months. He spent 10 minutes summarizing what had happened since his last contact in stream-of-consciousness Morse code. Kaylee's reply sounded as if she was overwhelmed. She keyed,
"BK, are you as sad as me? Woe is me. Woe is me. I miss you tons, Andy. I want to be there to sign your cast. XOXOXOXOXOX. BT."
After 3 months of hobbling around on crutches, Andy finally had his cast cut off. He was horrified to see how the muscles in his right leg had wasted away. Clearly, it would take several more months to fully replenish the muscle mass of the atrophied leg. He began walking more and more on the pair of crutches, then just one crutch and eventually just a cane. He walked farther and farther each day, pushing himself to the point of exhaustion. His days started with dozens of sit-ups and push-ups. Eventually, the length of the sets and the daily aggregate number of repetitions increased. He also started doing pull-ups, using the horizontal bar that held one end of the Mora's clothesline in their side yard. Andy's exercise time started to stretch into the evenings. Watching him do his pull-ups, Darcy commented,
"You're a driven man, Anders."
Bradfordsville, Kentucky, July, the second year. As the first summer that Sheila ran the store began, there were increasing requests for soda pop, mainly from the men who manned the town's three roadblocks. Sheila began offering more and more in trade for the dwindling supply of bartered soda in cans and bottles, simply because the men were progressively willing to pay more, even as much as 10 cents in silver per can of Coca-Cola or root beer. As this strange price inflation developed, Grandmère Emily wisely began collecting used beer bottles. She also traded a considerable quantity of ammunition for a bottle capping tool with a magnetic head and a 10-gross box of fresh bottle crown caps. These came from a maker of home-brewed beer who lived near Ellsberg. By June, she created her first batch of homemade root beer. She used spring water and locally grown birch bark, sarsaparilla root, ginger, burdock root, dandelion root, hops, wintergreen, and molasses in her secret recipe. Emily Voisin's first batch of root beer was uncarbonated and attracted a good number of customers. But her second and subsequent batches were carbonated using a large cylinder of CO2 and a special seltzering apparatus. Holland Combs had built this for Emily by scaling up the design from an old soda stream machine and using some hardware from his moribund soil analysis laboratory. These later batches of root beer were a huge success, so much so that Emily eventually had to hire seasonal help to wash bottles and help her brew root beer in the erstwhile butcher room of the Superior Market building. Grandma Emily's old-timey root beer attracted customers from as far away as Springfield and Munfordsville. She offered a discount to anyone who would return their bottles or sell her other brown glass bottles or who could provide fresh crown caps. Sheila Randall could not believe the first descriptions of the provisional government when she heard them. At first, she thought that they were wild exaggerations. Holland Combs warned her, "Whenever you hear of a government agency that declares itself legitimate in its own name, you gotta wonder about its legitimacy. Know what I mean? That gang of fools is about as legitimate as some Hollywood bimbo's baby." More and more customers patronizing her store reported seeing and hearing the same things about the Fort Knox government. In April of the second year, the first of a series of peacekeeping convoys passed through Bradfordsville. Most of these convoys stopped in town for less than a half hour. The soldiers were all Americans, as were their weapons and most of their vehicles. But something struck Sheila as odd when she overheard a radio conversation between the convoy's commander and his battalion commander. The latter had a distinctly German accent. Later, there were reports of entire battalion-sized foreign units deployed inside the Provgov's area of operations. Other than their control of key industries, the provisional government's authority seemed relatively benign in the first year. Then, a new currency was issued. The small, lime-green, watermarked bills soon reached general circulation and, by law, had to be accepted for all transactions. But the full weight of the provisional government and the guest UN peacekeepers wasn't felt until the third year after the crash, when firearms restrictions were enacted. Sheila Randall's first word of the new gun laws came when Brian Tompkins, an Armor Corps lieutenant, visited her store. One of the first things he said to her was, "You gotta make that gun disappear, or it'll get confiscated as contraband."
"Contraband?"
Tompkins answered.
"Yeah, haven't you heard? It sucks, but handguns have been banned for civilians, though you can still own some rifles and shotguns. It'll all be explained in the poster that we'll put up at your sheriff's office, and in some flyers the civil affairs guys will be handing out in town today."
The next day, Sheila saw two posters nailed up side by side on the wall in the main hall of the Marion County Sheriff's Department. A table beneath held a pile of flyers that duplicated the posters in a smaller format, printed on their front and back sides. As she stood reading the posters, Deputy Hodges walked up behind her and said softly,
"Hi, Sheila."
The poster on the left was a brief summary of the formation of the provisional government, a declaration of martial law, activation of the UN peacekeeping force, and nationalization of mass transportation and critical industries. The poster on the right read,
"BANNED. Effective upon posting in a prominent place in each county or parish, and in effect until further notice, the following items are hereby banned from private possession by the recently enacted Amplified United Nations Small Arms and Light Weapons, SALW, Normalization Accord. 1. All fully automatic or short-barreled rifles and shotguns, regardless of prior registration under the National Firearms Act of 1934. 2. Any rifle over 30 caliber, any shotgun or weapon of any description over 12 gauge in diameter. 3. All semi-automatic rifles and shotguns, all rifles and shotguns capable of accepting a detachable magazine. 4. Any detachable magazines, regardless of capacity. 5. Any weapon with a fixed magazine that has a capacity of more than 4 cartridges or shells. 6. All grenades and grenade launchers, all explosives, detonating cord, and blasting caps, regardless of prior registration under the Gun Control Act of 1968 or state or local blasting permits. 7. All explosives precursor chemicals. 8. All firearms, regardless of type, that are chambered for military cartridges, including but not limited to 7.62mm NATO, 5.56mm NATO, 45 caliber ACP, and 9mm Parabellum. 9. All silencers, regardless of prior registration under the National Firearms Act of 1934. 10. All night vision equipment, including but not limited to infrared, light amplification, or thermal, all telescopic sights, and all laser aiming devices. 11. All handguns, regardless of type or caliber. 12. Other distinctly military equipment, including but not limited to armored vehicles, bayonets, gas masks, helmets, and bulletproof vests. 13. Encryption software or devices. 14. All radio transmitters, other than baby monitors, cordless phones, or cell phones. 15. Full metal jacket, tracer, incendiary, and armor-piercing ammunition. 16. All ammunition in military calibers. 17. Irritant or lethal toxin chemical agents, including but not limited to CS and CN tear gas and OC pepper spray. 18. All military-type pyrotechnics and flare launchers. Exceptions only for properly trained and sworn police and the military forces of the UN and the sole and legitimate provisional government of the United States of America and possessions. Any firearm or other item not meeting the new criteria and all other contraband listed herein must be turned in within the 10-day amnesty period after the UN regional administrator or sub-administrator or their delegates arrive on site. Alternatively, if federal or UN troops arrive within any state to pacify it, a 30-day amnesty period will begin the day the first forces cross the state boundary. All other post-1898 production firearms of any description, air rifles, archery equipment, and edged weapons over 6 inches long, must be registered during the same period. Anyone found with an unregistered weapon or any weapon, accessory, or ammunition that has been declared contraband after the amnesty period ends will be summarily executed. As ordered under my hand, Maynard Hutchings, President Pro Tem of the sole and legitimate provisional government of the United States of America and possessions.
Sheila asked, "So, what does that leave us?"
Deputy Hodges answered,
"Not very much. I suppose 22s and antiques and maybe 30-30 lever actions. But even those have got to get registered. You know, that list won't do diddly in stopping crime, since, of course, criminals never obey any laws. But it's worded just right for squelching resistance. Notice how radio transmitters, military calibers, and night vision scopes are banned? Maynard's list would make Hitler or Stalin proud. This whole thing stinks." Gesturing to the SIG 556 rifle on his shoulder, he pressed on. "Now, why is it legal for me to have this as a deputy, but not you? That's just plain unconstitutional. If and when they come into Marion County and try to enforce that load of hog wallop, they'd better be ready for one mighty big gunfight." That evening, Sheila hid her revolver, ammo, and holster inside the bin of a hand-cranked Seed broadcaster. She hung it up on the wall near the ceiling, amidst the profusion of overstock items in the store's back room.
she explained to Tyree.
Sometimes it's best to just hide things in plain sight. I want to be able to get to that in a hurry, too.
Chapter 31. A Bulwark Never Failing. Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Mao Zedong. Fort Knox, Kentucky. August, the second year. Maynard Hutchings and his cronies laid out their goals like a military campaign. Military bases, food distribution warehouses, power plants, oil fields, and refineries topped their list of sites to be controlled. Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, and Mississippi were the first states to be pacified. Chambers Clark was the Undersecretary of Information for the Hutchings government. He accompanied many of the first convoys that contacted military installations and served as liaison for the PROVGOV. Before the crunch, Clark had been a fertilizer and pesticide salesman for Monsanto Company. In many ways, Clark was just a bagman for the administration. He literally handed out millions of dollars in the new currency to the owners of mines that were being nationalized. It was Hutchings' wife who had first suggested the carrot-and-stick approach to nationalizing the industries. Mr. Clark was the carrot, while General Ulloch provided the stick. Later, it was the UN peacekeepers that provided the whippings, with fewer compunctions than American troops. One of the council's first goals was controlling oil refineries. Hutchings initially dispatched an APC convoy to a small refinery in Pulaski County, Kentucky, near the town of Somerset. It was a very small refinery by 21st century standards, producing just 5,500 barrels per day. But it was online, so Hutchings had a source of fuel to expand his area of influence. They next visited and served papers on the much larger refineries in Callitsburg and Perry, Kentucky, but both were offline because the power grid was down and they lacked sufficient cogeneration capacity. The pacification, reunification, and nationalization campaign's first large prize was the ConocoPhillips refinery in Ponca City, Oklahoma. It was the largest refinery in the state of Oklahoma, and it was still partially online. After Ponca City, the Army advanced on the Oklahoma refineries in Ardmore, Tulsa, Wynnewood, and Thomas. Of these, only the Ventura refinery at Thomas was in operation. In Ohio, all of the refineries that the Fort Knox government visited were found to be offline. The regular pinging of bullets bouncing off their APCs as they advanced served as a reminder that Ohio was still unpacified country. A combination of harsh winter weather and the ravenous gangs had reduced the population by 87%. The only people left in Ohio were the gang members and a handful of farmers who had become accustomed to paying the gang's so-called fair share crop taxes. Meanwhile, other convoys were dispatched to electric power plants. These, coal, natural gas, and hydroelectric, were another high priority for the PROVGOV. The hydroelectric plants were the easiest to get back online, and in fact, a few of them were already operating on isolated mini-grids that had been reestablished soon after the crunch took down the big power grids. Because it takes a source of power to start up a gas turbine engine, and because most power plants in the U.S. built after the 1960s didn't have auxiliary power units for self-starting, the black start restarting process took several months to gradually work up the capacity to get the biggest power plants in Kentucky back online. These included the Big Sandy, Ghent, Mill Creek, and Paradise power plants. Reconstituting the eastern power grid step by step, starting with the smallest power plants, was time-consuming and required a lot of manpower. Some of the manpower had to be procured with a combination of Fort Knox greenbacks and coercion. At first, coal miners refused to accept pay in the new currency. It finally took the promise of relatively high pay
and the threat of involuntary servitude to get them back to work. The PravGov's first experience with nuclear power plants came when they nationalized the Watts Bar nuclear plant in Ray County, Tennessee. The plant had been operating uninterrupted since before the crunch. As with some of the hydro plants, a mini-power grid was already in service there, and it merely needed to be expanded and tied back to the new grid. The reconstituted grid was often jokingly called Maynard's Bubblegum and Baling Wire Power Grid. The cobbled-together Fort Knox grid was plagued by frequent blackouts and brownouts. Severe conservation measures were the norm. Storm damage often took months to repair. The level of expectation for reliability of service soon was on a par with third world countries. Meanwhile, the residential rate charged was an average of 25 cents per kilowatt hour in the new dollars, which kept consumption low. Local power distribution co-ops were allowed to be independent and privately owned, but it was mandated that they pay their employees in the new currency. Dissent from the new administration was rapidly quashed, often with brute force tactics. Newspapers that printed editorials opposing the nationalization schemes often had their offices burned to the ground. Radio stations that voiced anti-government views had their transmitters destroyed or their transmitter towers dynamited. Anti-government banners were torn down. In some cases, activists disappeared, never to be seen again. The Oconee Nuclear Station in South Carolina was a difficult challenge. There, they found that the employees were standing guard with an odd assortment of weapons that included homemade flamethrowers. Talking them into opening the gate was difficult, because they had heard rumors that the provisional government was engaging in terrorism and had sabotaged another nuclear power plant. It was only through a mixture of threats and bribes that they were able to enter the plant. Like the other nuclear power plants that they had liberated, the provisional government found that the plant was still capable of going back online, but the local power infrastructure was in disarray. There were downed power poles, trees down on power lines, and miles of copper wire that had been stolen. The military bases fell either very easily or with great difficulty. In some cases, all that the provisional government had to do was wait until their convoys arrived and announce that the base commander was either being given new orders or was being relieved. This worked well at their first destination, Fort Campbell, Kentucky. They found Little Rock Air Force Base and Tinker Air Force Base were both semi-abandoned. The commander at Arnold Air Force Base in Oklahoma simply rolled over and played dead. Offutt Air Base, near Omaha, Nebraska, proved to be one of the toughest nuts to crack. The base commander would not recognize Hutchings' provisional government. Rather than fighting the small Air Force security contingent toe-to-toe, General Ulick decided to simply back off and starve them out. They did the same with Camp Gruber, Oklahoma. The Army National Guard general there told Chambers Clark that in the absence of orders from Forcecom or the Pentagon, he would take orders only from the governor of Oklahoma. Surrounding and starving out Offutt and Camp Gruber took just 6 months and resulted in only a few casualties. There was brief resistance at Fort Riley, Kansas, but the fort's commander eventually acceded to a combination of threats and a substantial bribe in gold. By the time that Fort Rucker, Alabama, came under the Hutchings government, the latter controlled the majority of the remaining airworthy helicopters in the U.S. Army inventory. Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, yielded a huge number of trained troops that were integrated into the provisional government's army. The army soon earned the moniker the Federals. Fort Sill, Oklahoma, the home of the U.S. Army's artillery school, was semi-chaotic when the Federals arrived, but its huge store of ammunition was still secure and intact. Fort Gordon, Georgia, was controlled by a corrupt and unstable general who was mistrusted by his own troops. The arrival of the Federals came as a relief to the troops there, mostly Signal Corps, but they were soon disillusioned to find that the provisional government leadership was even more corrupt than that of their former commander. When the army reached the coast,